Murder Row discusses themes of homicide, violence, sexual assault, and at times uses explicit language. Listener discretion is highly recommended.
My name is Liz, and I'm not sure I should be doing this.
I grew up on Murder Road. That's not the actual name of the road, that's just what people called it when I needed a ride home from play rehearsal. "It's dark and I'm scared of Murder Road," was a standard response when I'd ask if people could drop me off at home. It was actually a beautiful place to grow up most of the time.
Now, I'm an adult. And now, as a parent, I wonder what happened to some of these people. We were always told not to worry about it because they were just dropped off there. They weren't actually killed there. Like that was some kind of consolation. What concerns me is that by doing this, I'm kind of opening myself up to not just scrutiny, but potentially making myself and my family a target. And that's not really the best idea. But I feel really compelled to do this because I've spent my entire life wondering how some of these people ended up there, who they were, and what happened to them. My two best friends are helping me. Please don't expect there to be a high production value. Don't expect there to be any resolution, because this is 30 years that we're talking about almost, and we still have no answers. All we have are dead bodies.
Welcome to Murder Road Podcast. My best friends are here helping me, and they are...
I'm Katie. Hi.
I'm Misty. Hi.
So I'm not sure if everyone noticed when we released an update to our original episode, but I wanted to revisit it because it's important to me. We released the first episode on the 26th anniversary of the discovery of the murder of Lisa Waters and Andy Hoosey. That's November 6th, 1993. I feel like it's important because for 26 years, a community has wondered. For 26 years, there have been doubts, rumors, and speculation, which is why we chose the release date we did, and frankly, rushed it out. So our effort here, even if we don't come up with any answers, it's to at least update the public, because look, I know everybody's been wondering, I sure have. It's been a quarter of a century, and we all have questions. So, Katie, anything you got to say?
Yes, we plan on releasing an episode every month. I know that is a longer gap than a lot of our listeners are used to, but this is a real-time investigation. We didn't start this months and months and months ahead of time to be able to have the content to be able to update you once a week. You are finding stuff out as we are finding stuff out. Each episode, we are going to update you on what we have found as we're finding it. We may not have answers. We may have more questions than when we started, but we will cover what we can. And then each episode, we are going to take a closer look at a specific topic. Coming up next, we will take a closer look at the background of Fewtown Road and dive into some of that sordid history we mentioned in the first episode. And then from there, we will take a closer look at each of the individual cases, get into some grisly details.
It doesn't matter what we find, what we uncover, good or bad. We're going to be honest. We're going to tell you exactly what we find. And it may be a very slow, boring process, but it may also be interesting. And I really appreciate everybody coming along with us for this journey. And I really appreciate people helping us bring attention back to these cases and keep these people's memories alive. It's important. Those people mattered, just like everybody else does.
Some people have asked us how they can help support this investigation and this podcast. And right now, the best thing you can do to help support us, support this investigation, and support the Murder Road podcast is to rate and review on iTunes or whichever platform you listen to your podcasts. I know it wasn't out on the 6th on every streaming platform because there was some lag time in the approval and the upload process, but that is being sorted out, and we're slowly working the kinks out, so we just ask you to be patient with us there. Yeah, just share and spread the word, share the link, subscribe, subscribe, download, and then give us a review. That helps other people find us.
Hey, and I'd like to note too, I really appreciate all of the community support we've gotten. I appreciate all of the reviews that I have received. Look, all that stuff helps. It really does. And really, look, this whole podcast, it's a community affair. So I really appreciate you guys all being here for it.
All right. right, welcome back to Murder Road. What have you ladies found this week?
Oh, gosh. Well, so when we started this out, my cousin and I were talking about it before I ever actually jumped into this. And she and I both remembered there being three girls murdered that year. And I've racked my brain for literally years trying to figure out who this third girl was. You know, I've talked to a lot of people. I've got a lot of community members I'm sourcing for all of this. And one person in particular told me about a girl named Doc. And we still don't know who Doc is. That's a whole different thing. And we haven't gotten to that part yet. But I assume we will. We also found out about another murder and another girl that may be the murder that we were remembering, my cousin and I. And this girl's name, well, she wasn't a girl. She was 22. She was a mother of, what, four or five?
Four.
Her name was Virginia Evely Lekorchik. She was born in West Virginia. She was raised in Alliance and Sebring, Ohio. She was murdered in 1993, I think July 10th.
Yep.
And a guy went to jail for her murder. His name is Robert Moore. He's been convicted and served his time already. I don't know all the specifics on that, but when I first heard Robert Moore's name, I was told that he didn't do it, that he went to jail for someone else. And the someone else was a family name that I've heard several other times from other community members. They all say, oh, well, somebody went to jail for it, but so-and-so did it. And it's a family name, a plural name that I'm not going to name here because, you know, that's an accusation. So
can we just call them the Smiths?
Okay, sure. Yeah. So every time I talk to somebody in the community, they say, oh, well, so-and-so went to jail for it, but the Smiths did it. Except for I have no evidence of that. All I know is that's what four different people in the community have told me. And once again, it comes down to, you know, speculation and rumor. So this week we went on an adventure finding out who Virginia Lekorchik was.
Yep.
Do you have anything to say about her?
Sure. So Virginia Lekorchik, as we said, was born in West Virginia. Her maiden name is Rutan. She was 22 when she passed away, and she had four children. She only had an education level of ninth grade, and she was listed as a housewife or homemaker at her time of death. And she was married. From what, if I can remember, I think it looked like she got married at 16 or 15. But 16 would have meant that her parents, someone had to sign for it. And that is almost all I could find out about her. You never did find a yearbook with Virginia in it, did you?
No.
It's like, I think the year we need is gone. It's not there. Because I think it would have been 85. Or whichever one was just absolutely missing.
I think it was 82.
It's just gone.
I don't know what all we know about her. I know that later on in 2015, her daughter, Billie Jean Lekorchik, mm-hmm. died from a drug overdose. And that is just tragic.
And that comes up a lot because her case actually got all the way to almost the Supreme Court because of, can you charge someone for providing drugs?
Right.
And it killing somebody.
What was the outcome?
I could not find it.
No, her...
Did it actually go
yes.
through? And it,
yeah, he actually could? Was
well,
charged.
Well, he was charged, but it was his case that was being brought up to be overturned. Because
I think he did go to jail for it,
yeah.
though. I don't know if it got overturned or
right.
not. Yeah, I don't know. It's just a sad, sad story. It's like, so this woman.
And that was her youngest, if I'm correct.
So she grew up without her mom,
mm-hmm.
who got murdered.
Mm-hmm.
The kid probably had a lot to deal with growing up. And so, you know.
Had a lot of kids herself, did she know that?
I think she had five kids, mm-hmm. yeah. So it's kind of like, it's pretty indicative of the cycle
mm-hmm.
of tragedy.
It is.
And which is crushing.
No, it's just sad.
It really is. That's what we learned this week was that Virginia Lekorchik may have been the third murder that happened that year that me and my cousin were trying to remember and nobody could name. And the reason we couldn't look it up as an unsolved murder is because somebody did in fact get convicted. And the person who went to prison for it declined an interview, mm-hmm. which I respect.
Right.
You know,
I really wish he would have given an interview. I really want to know why he killed her.
He might. He might still. Especially if he's not actually guilty.
Right, and if we tell him we're not trying to...
Or if he is guilty, I just want to know why.
Yeah. Well, if he's not guilty, he might be more likely to give an interview right. if we tell him we are trying to prove that you're not guilty. Right. And if we can do that, then...
Her life was hard enough. She was 22 with 4 kids. What does that tell you?
Right, and a 9th grade education.
And a 9th grade education. And I'm just going to add that this was not her husband. Her husband did not kill her.
Correct. Yeah, because that's the first thing people think. Right. Oh, the husband did it, yeah, but not this time.
No.
Which is important to note. Mm-hmm. Is there anything you would like to add about Virginia?
Oh, no, not right now. I think you two pretty much covered it.
Is there anything else you want to talk about?
Yeah, I'd like to... kind of share some of the other things that we found looking through newspaper archives.
Absolutely.
One of the things that had bothered me when we first started looking into this was that I couldn't find an obituary for either Lisa Waters or Andy Hoosie online. And I thought that was really strange since Andy was the son of a police officer. Since his dad worked for the Portage County Sheriff, not only did he work there, he was a lieutenant in the Portage County Sheriff's Department. And so why wasn't there any kind of information online? Why wasn't there an obituary online? But we were able to find an obituary by poring through old newspaper records, which I will read you now.
That's impressive, actually.
This was published in the Record Courier on Monday, November 8th, 1993. Anthony W. Andy Hoosie, 31, of Parkway Drive in Deerfield, died Saturday. Born August 13th, 1962 in Barberton, he was the son of Gordon and Carol Graham Hoosie. He had been a Portage County resident since 1970. He was a 1981 graduate of Garfield High School. He was a member of the Ravenna Eagles and the Ravenna Moose. Besides his parents, survivors include his sisters, Dorothy Bartholomew of Kent, and Rebecca Lane of Newton Falls. Calling hours will be from 7 to 9 p.m. Tuesday at the Shorts Funeral Home, Ravenna Chapel, where services will be at 1 p.m. Wednesday, with the Reverend John Garrett officiating. Burial will be in Deerfield Cemetery. I'm glad I was able to find an obituary, but it still feels really short and really...
insufficient.
Very insufficient. Just really cut and dry. Just all facts, no feeling.
Yeah. And that's a shame.
It is, yeah.
But it is what it is.
Glad you were able to find something.
Yeah, I also found that his first name was actually Anthony.
Right.
His given name was Anthony. And we just went by Andy.
That's odd.
So I wonder where the articles got Andrew. We've seen several news reports that call him Andrew mm-hmm. Lucy.
Huh.
So I wonder where that came from.
I didn't even notice that.
His dad. That's my guess.
Maybe. But if his name is Anthony W, he's got a middle name of mm-hmm. that starts with W.
It'd be a nickname or it'd be just a family name or something. Somebody yeah. always called him.
Yeah, Andy sounds more like a nickname than Andrew, right. though. If I was going to nickname my kid, it would mm-hmm. be a little bit shorter than a full name.
No, absolutely right. Or a reporter wrote it first and then...
That's kind of what I'm thinking. I'm mm-hmm. thinking it just kind of snowballed from there and right. somebody decided, oh, Andy is going to be Andrew right. because I'm going to sound more official.
Yeah.
And then subsequent articles quoted that article and right. there it went.
Yeah.
And 26 years later, we're all wondering... Why is Andrew Hoosie nowhere online?
Right.
Because his name's Anthony, that's why.
Did you find anything interesting in newspaper articles, Liz? I did, but it's all about Kathy, so I want to save it for another episode.
Anything about Lisa?
Very little.
Seriously.
Very little.
That's a shame.
There was an article that talked to her, that did talk to her dad and her cousin.
Oh.
And so that was, made it a little more personal, but that was it.
I'm just glad this week that you were able to confirm that, I mean, I'm not glad that there was another murder, but you were able to confirm a memory that you hadn't had.
Yeah, actually. And
of another person.
I think we were talking about that earlier, you and I, in the car, how, you know, your memory plays tricks.
It does.
The human brain, when it can't remember something that it knows it should, it facilitates a memory. I'm not saying we make it up, but our brains kind of make it up. So I'm glad to know that I was not imagining that.
Right.
Growing up where I did has made me a very weird person. As a kid, I empathized with the girls that they found, and I was afraid that I would be them someday. And now, as an adult, now I empathize with the parents and the families. And somehow it's much different and much worse. It was actually a really beautiful place to grow up most of the time. We had so much fun. Swimming, racing bikes up and down the road, fishing, hiking. But there was a struggle going on that we knew nothing about as kids. Our property was a big empty lot. Our land had been used as a dumping ground for glass and pottery. In fact, we spent the first few years literally picking broken pieces out of the yard and trying to grow grass where there was nothing but clay. We reclaimed the land and made it into a home. We grew gardens and built things, and it was a good place to grow up in general. We literally had to defend our home from the very beginning. Our road had, for several years, been where biker gangs and the mafia used to settle their disputes, allegedly. They'd conduct business, do drugs. It was a known party spot that the sheriffs didn't much bother with. It was also used for hunting and fishing. The Army Reserves used to go back there and do training and drills. My dad and neighbor would take pickup trucks and block off the end of the road with shotguns. My dad and uncles and our neighbor became sort of like a militia. So they kind of had like undeclared permission to be their own law enforcement. They also kind of had to, because we're a pretty poor area, and I doubt the sheriffs could afford to have monitored the road as much as they actually needed to. In fact, a lot of times, even though they were their own militia, and that sounds kind of scary, they were also our own first responders. I can't tell you how many cars my dad and my neighbor had to pull out of the ditch with like giant tractors and their pickup trucks. But when biker gangs would go back there, I remember nights that you could hear screaming, fighting, chains hitting metal at all hours. It was pretty wild, in many senses of the word. It was also a beautiful, magical place to grow up. My parents loved us so much that they turned a barren clay field full of shards of pottery into a verdant green palace. They loved us so much that they almost single-handedly fought back the forces of evil. Evil just wasn't ready to give it up that easily. Our home was like some kind of beacon in the night. Anytime somebody got in trouble at the end of the road, ours was the first place they'd stop looking for help, even though we weren't the first house they'd encounter. I remember one morning being woken up by a wailing woman. She looked like some kind of ghost in the early morning light. My parents chased us back to our bedroom, but not before we got an eyeful of this woman whose dark hair was wild and she was standing there completely naked. Over her pendulous breasts was tattooed the word Marge in big letters. She was bloody. She had rooted through our trash cans and had cut herself with a soup can lid, presumably trying to kill herself. Maybe she was on drugs. Maybe she had been the subject of rough use by a bad boyfriend. Maybe it was a bad trick. I'll never know. But I remember feeling like it took days waiting for the ambulance later to come and take her back to the mental hospital that we found out she was a frequent guest of. I've always felt guilty for how scared of the poor woman I had been. I was a kid, sure, but I still feel bad. She was a survivor and clearly deserved compassion. I've always wondered what happened to her after that. It was the first incident my kid brain remembers about whatever went on at the back of the road. It was before they found Andy Hoosie and Lisa Waters. Before they found the dead girl chained to a parking barrier at the ice cream stand on 225. very near to us. Before they found the bodies of Kathy Menendez, naked, beaten, and strangled, and Sarah Baim, clearly the same, but much more skeletal. It's hard to reconcile my basically idyllic childhood, catching crayfish in the creek, lying in the warm summer grass under trees, thinking how boring it was, and using my imagination. It's hard to reconcile that with everything that happened after Marge. Marge was just the first warning that I'd spend a lot of my life afraid and extra vigilant, living a conflict of being scared and being resentful of being scared.
Everything I've talked about so far has been from my perspective as a kid, but what was life like on Fewtown Road for adults? Just days after Kathy Menendez was found in August 1994, the Record Courier quoted a Fewtown Road resident as saying, "This is a lonesome and terrible place, and when the dope addicts and ruffians get in there, it's not a very good place." The same person related to the paper that they didn't even go outside on their own property unarmed.
So it sounds like he knew about that.
Everybody did.
Yeah, it sounds like
it was a given. Everybody knew what Fewtown Road was about before people started moving in there and trying to make it a decent place to live.
Well, it's just, it's kind of out of the way. It's wooded.
It's unsupervised.
Private. It's unsupervised. It's a very good place to go and do XYZ.
Or to just disappear.
Right.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Or to disappear somebody else.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, clearly.
By the time Sarah Baim was found in November 1994, the area residents wanted to close the end of Fewtown Road off. Another resident offered to donate a gate he owned to speed the process up. It turned out that neither Deerfield Township nor Portage County Sheriff had the authority to close the road. The decision ultimately fell to the Ohio Department of Natural Resources, since it was technically state land on either side of the road at that point. During the time the township trustees were petitioning the Ohio Department of Natural Resources to close the road, more like squabbling over who had to pay for it, I'm sure, both the sheriff and the Ohio Department of Natural Resources increased patrols in the area. The Deerfield Fire Chief told the Record Courier that the fire department would no longer respond to calls in the area placed after dark without a sheriff's office escort. How dangerous does a place have to be? How scared does a community have to be to refuse emergency services without an armed escort? To try and answer that, we need to know what people's lived experiences were beyond what the newspaper reported. We talked to Jeannie, a longtime resident of Fewtown Road, and here's what she had to say. What we're working on is we're painting a picture, you know, of what life was like back here. I mean, I know there were biker gangs and stuff, but what was it like here? Because I was little and I don't remember all of it. I remember some of it, but not all of it.
It was weird because this was one of those roads that there was really no houses on.
We moved in the 80s, 84. It was a trailer, a two-bedroom trailer.
The trailer that we moved into was here, mm-hmm. but the man that owned it never lived in it. Mm-hmm. He built the garage first, and then he brought the trailer out to, he eventually was going to move into it. And decided he was from Akron, decided that it was too far out for him.
Were there any other houses on the street?
On the end, the first house and the one across the road were both there. The trailer wasn't there, or cabin wasn't there. It was just us. And then there was a trailer on the other side of it. And that was all that was on this road, mm-hmm. I think. There was a lot of traffic to the lake and back out all the time, like crazy. It was a busy place.
Because swimming and fishing and hunting, mm-hmm. and that's all legitimate stuff.
Right.
What I'm more concerned about is all the crazy shit.
Yeah, there was a lot of crazy shit.
Like what?
We had ROTC come back here for training a couple nights, a couple weekends, and you could hear them doing their drills.
I know. I like that better than the biker gangs because at least it wasn't scary.
Yeah, the biker gangs came in. You knew what they were going to do. The cops knew what they were going to do, and the cops would avoid here unless they got called here.
Yep.
How often did that happen?
Oh, probably, I'd say at that time, at least once a month, if not more.
In the summer times, for sure, once mm-hmm. a month.
Yeah.
Do you remember if it was regularly scheduled? Did it seem to be a pattern to it?
No. Mm-hmm. No, the pattern, there was no pattern because the cops would have figured it out, but they didn't, so.
And do you remember how long after you guys had been living here that you started to notice the biker gangs coming in and out?
Oh, it was right away. Well, they would come in. The two motorcycle groups would come in to meet down here to fight.
Yeah.
And the cops knew they were coming.
Yeah. Were they coming down? Were they coming in from to the 225 side?
Yeah, 225.
So they would have come right past your house to go back there. Yeah.
All of them.
Well, the only other way to get here is by boat.
It wouldn't be just one or two bikes. It'd be 25, 40 bikes go by together. And you knew. I mean, the only thing you do is pray they don't look at you because your kids are out there. And
like, what were biker gangs like at the time, just in general?
For me, they were all scary because I didn't realize part of them were good. And they were all black. And so I'm a white kid from a white background. I don't know much about black people in general.
So they were all black biker gangs?
Both gangs were black.
But that was the only gangs that would go back there?
That's the only ones I ever saw go back there. And at that time, there was not very many white bikers that would come down this road.
Okay. Side note here. This seems like an all too easy cliche to make. Like, oh, there's some shenanigans going on. It must be the black guys up to no good again. Let me be absolutely clear. That is not what we're insinuating here. And I don't think that's what Jeannie was trying to say either. Deerfield and Portage County overall are both overwhelmingly white. I think she mentions this because in such a whitewashed environment, it's easy for one person of color to stand out in someone's memory over 100 white people doing the exact same thing. Thanks, systemic racism. Honestly, I struggle with how or if to present this information, but we promised honesty, so we're playing Jeannie's words, her perspective, and experience as she relayed them to us. Anyway, back to the interview.
When you first moved in, did you know that this was like a high-frequent party area?
I didn't, because I'm not a party. You know, I was raising kids, and it was out in the country, and I thought they'd be safe.
When you guys bought this place and moved in, you were just looking for a nice, quiet place out in the...
Right, and it was in the middle of a field. There was no lawn. There was piles where they had brought stuff out from town and dumped it, and it was real primitive.
Do you remember when Dad and all the uncles and some other people, they all parked pickup trucks down there and cut off the end of the road? Do you remember that?
Yeah, but I can't remember exactly what the accomplishment was. I know it was to stop traffic back there. Well, you could put your boat in down there. There was a landing. Mm-hmm. We had a boat at that time. We went to the lake a lot. Mm. Because it was cheap entertainment. There's no lights down there. There was no... It's primitive. You're parking in the dark. You're parking your trailer in the dark. So we tried to go in early and get out early because we didn't know what was going to find down there. There'd be people fishing off the bank, drinking and being crazy. And you don't want your kids around that. So you try to get them out of there before all that happens. I've seen stop cars that were racing down this road. They would drag race. Random people. They've had people that would be on the hood and be hood surfing, car surfing.
Willingly?
Yeah. And he would stop them and say, you know, I got kids here. You need to stop this.
How did
Find someplace else to be.
How did he stop them?
357. Pulled it out, and, you know.
Just waved it around?
Yes, like, you guys need to stop. And he didn't shoot anybody, but they didn't know he wouldn't. But he said, I have a family here. You need to find another road.
Did they eventually?
Yeah, eventually they did, because word got out that was not going to be a nice person to deal with on this road.
How long did that take?
Year or two. Well, and then as our kids grew up, they would say, you know, my dad will knock your head off. My dad will take you out. And that really spread the word really fast. But, you know, dad's insane. Dad's a nutbag. But he did. He packed a pistol, and he didn't hide it. I mean, he had it strapped, you know. It's like... You're going to play this game, you're going to do it on my road, and I can't get the law to help.
And Ohio's always been an open carry state, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
We had a lot of people that would go back high and would wreck into trees because the road back there is real snaky.
Yeah, it winds.
Yeah. And so if there's any snow or any water or anything, it's a narrow road, and if you overreact or underreact, you're going to wear a tree. And we had a lot of that.
What about Bigfoot sightings?
They have that on YouTube. There's filming of this road with Bigfoot.
Has that been a thing for a long time?
As far as I can remember.
You said that has been as far back as you can remember?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Because this is one of those roads where, you know, it's like primitive camping. You know, it's like ghost stories. And they just roll out and get bigger.
So is the state land back there? Or at least, or was it at one time open for primitive camping?
I think at one time it was. I know it was open for hunting. It's always been open for hunting.
What are some of the other, like, urban myths that about... What was that one about the witch's house?
There was a point on
on the lake. It had a fireplace that was freestanding fireplace. And supposedly at one point that was a witch's point, the witch's house. Mm-hmm. It had at one time been a cabin there, they said. And I can't even take you back to it. I know it's in the woods, and it was on one of the points from the lake. You can see it. You could see the stove, the
fireplace.
So that. was it more like ruins and yeah. just kind of like the hearth remained, or was yeah. it?
No, like it's just like the hearth, and there was never any what I would call stuff that identified it as anything other than a legend.
But teenagers would go back yeah. there looking for it and stuff.
Yeah, and they go back there and party and scare themselves to death.
So it wasn't one of those outdoor warming stations they put by ice skating rinks and stuff.
No, I honestly wondered if it maybe at one point had been like an Indian or settlers start a house. But
mm-hmm. Do you know if this was native land at one time?
I don't have a clue.
Yeah,
I mean it would have to have been at some point.
I think the whole country was native land, but
right.
Yeah, I would think.
And you could actually at night hear chains hitting metal. It was disturbing.
Sounds very disturbing.
Yeah. You guys can hear that from your house?
Oh, yeah. I could hear it from my bed at night.
That's terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. It was exciting.
I know that you've said that before. I don't know if we've recorded it.
Yeah.
I don't think I wouldn't be able to sleep for sure.
It was challenging. It was more comforting when the Army Reserves used to started coming back there to train, and you could hear them at night. Oh. You could hear them doing push-ups. Whoop, hop, hop. And it was like this big group of guys. You could hear them. They were yelling, and they would all call in response.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was interesting, and it was a lot more comforting than the chains on metal, let me tell you.
That's good.
And I know that in a lot of articles I've read just to do with Kathy's death, Sarah's death, they talk about biker gangs.
Mm-hmm. To me, biker gangs kind of sounds like an elusive scare,
right?
like satanic cults. Like,
right. Exactly. I wonder, what do they mean? Was there just a specific biker group that liked to meet out there? Did they do poker runs out there?
Yeah.
What, you know, what did they mean by that?
So we asked Jeannie who they are. Now, which gangs was it?
It was the Brothers Regime and the Pagans is one of them.
Holy crap, the Pagans? Seriously? No wonder it was so loud and scary.
If you're not familiar with the Pagans...
I am, actually.
I wasn't, so this was all new to me. They are a national biker gang, or MC, motorcycle club, but are more present on the East Coast, especially New York, New Jersey, Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Ohio. They are considered one of the FBI's Big Four outlaw MCs, along with the likes of the Hells Angels and the Outlaws.
They are small but mighty. Earlier I mentioned that I feel like biker gangs are like a satanic panic, like a weird...
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
yeah. Like a weird 80s fear that doesn't actually
sure,
exist.
Sure, and I grew up, all my uncles were bikers. Mm-hmm. All of them, yeah. Every last one, even the ones that I actually knew their full names.
Yeah.
And I had all these other uncles that were not biologically related that definitely I did not know their real names.
My uncles are bikers too, and there's a lot of biker groups and a lot of biker clubs that do a lot of good. The way I associate biker gangs and motorcycle clubs are poker runs, charity runs,
right.
Toy drives. Like the whole like big scary bikes
yeah.
with chains and spiked bats and
right.
stuff just kind of really only exist in like 80s cheese movies to me.
Except for on Few Town Road.
Except for the fact that some of those really do exist.
Correct.
And
it does go on. That's the thing.
It did go on.
I know because I used to stay up late at night hearing it.
It still does go on. But the fact is only about 1% of biker gangs are violent, are running drugs. It's to the extent that the Pagans even call themselves a proud 1%er gang.
Explain that, the proud 1%.
Yes, because to me, when I hear 1%er, I think the richest of the rich,
the
right.
Occupy
one,
movement.
Yeah, the 1%er
means
yeah.
rich.
In biker subculture, a 1%er means violent. It means criminal.
It
means
outlaw. Those rare few who are willing to just go completely bananas.
And they call themselves that because according to a former president, and I saw this on a Gangland documentary, a former president of the Pagans was quoted as saying that 99% of the people in the world will abide by society's rules and comply with societal norms and try to act appropriately for the situation. And then 1% just does not give a fuck.
Correct.
And that 1%, those are the people the pagans want. And I also found something that said that term 1%er came from a newspaper article that was covering a bike rally where the Hells Angels showed up, the pagans showed up, a bunch of other bikers showed up. And they said, the reporter said that only 1% of the bikers there were there to cause problems. But I couldn't actually substantiate that.
Right.
It was just kind of secondhand saying that this was in a paper, this was in a newspaper. I couldn't actually find the article. So I don't know if that's true or not, but the former president of the pagans, that I was able to verify that. So 1% of these guys are out to cause trouble.
Sure.
99% of the bikers you meet are going to be very sweet, very normal human beings, just like the rest of us. The pagans differ from most MCs in that they don't have an official clubhouse or head location. Pagan patches or colors don't include what's called a bottom rocker, showing the wearer's location. This was a deliberate decision, so law enforcement can't tell where members are from, making the group much harder to track. The Hells Angels are probably familiar to most people, at least in name or reputation. The pagans are the Hells Angels' arch nemesis. They allegedly murdered a Hells Angels higher-up and caused one of their Philadelphia chapters to close as a result.
The other gang Jeannie mentioned is the Brothers Regime. How do they fit in?
While we don't know much about the Brothers Regime, we do know they were involved in a high-profile shootout in 2016 that left two of their top members dead and others injured. The shootout was with a rival gang who has ties to white supremacy, as well as drugs and weapons trafficking. We also know that they're still active today.
They still have a clubhouse right by that little weird center of the world town.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Warren.
We can go there.
She was talking about the Brothers Regime, and I assumed that meant the Brothers of the Hammer.
No, Brothers Regime.
Which is current thing in Alliance.
Right. Brothers Regime, I believe, is different.
I agree. And after your research and some of the stuff that I read, it's like, no, it's a different thing.
Sometimes the pagans wear insignia with ties to white supremacy too, right?
Yeah, it doesn't make sense.
What doesn't?
Jeannie remembered the pagans and Brothers Regime going down Fewtown and said they were all black bikers, but the pagans are pretty much all white, some even wearing Nazi colors. I don't know specifically if the Brothers Regime are white supremacists, but their logo looks Nazi AF. And I've only seen white people in their photos online. Jeannie's certainty that the biker gangs were all black doesn't seem to line up with the facts about both the pagans and the Brothers Regime. Memory's a funny thing, you know? Could Jeannie have been remembering the names of the biker gangs incorrectly? Could she have seen one or two black bikers and assumed that the rest were all black too? We needed answers because it matters if the pagans frequented the road. Their ties in organized crime and drug running could mean that these murders go much deeper than we thought, and getting answers and even getting folks to talk with us could be that much harder. Unfortunately, the people we reached out to for clarification haven't responded yet. So if you were or know someone who was a part of that biker community in the early 90s, please drop us a line. We want to talk to you.
That about wraps it up for this month. Thank you so much for listening. Tune in next month for part two. We'll talk about organized crime in the area and if they could be linked with the two of the Berlin Reservoir murders. Hopefully we have an update and more clarification about the different biker clubs and what they might have been doing back there also.
These murders are still able to be solved even after 25 years. Someone out there knows something. Maybe after 25 years, they'll be more willing to speak. Maybe old grudges have faded and old relationships have crumbled. And maybe the people whose secrets they're holding have passed on or moved away. Maybe they don't even know these crimes aren't solved yet. Maybe even somebody listening remembers something that might be the key to solving any one of these four murders. If you have any information, no matter how insignificant it may seem, about the deaths of Andy Hussey, Lisa Waters, Sarah Bame, or Catherine Menendez, please contact the Portage County Sheriff's Cold Case Information Line at 330-297-3890 or the FBI in Cleveland at 216-522-1400 or Pittsburgh at 412-432-4000. If you're not comfortable contacting law enforcement directly, you can reach out to us and we'll let them know anonymously if you wish. You can find us on Twitter at Murder Road Pod, and you can email us at murderroadpodcast@gmail.com. You can also find us on Instagram at Murder Road Podcast. Also, we play by Murder Squad rules here. Please no naming names in public, no side-by-side photos, don't dox each other, and just be nice out there.
I also would like to include a note that we will protect people's anonymity to the best of our ability every time. It's important.
So if you do reach out to us and you're afraid of being on air, having your name played on air, all you have to do is request that we don't, and we will honor your wishes.
Absolutely.
Thanks so much for listening, and until next time, it's never too late to make a difference.
This week's episode is researched and written by Trifecta Media, LLC. Research sources include The Record Courier, The Alliance Review, Cleveland Scene Magazine, The Gangland Docuseries, WKYC News, TheAgingRebel.com, and Personal Interviews. Featured music is by Penguin Music and by Palmcat Studios. For any other information regarding our episode, please consult the show notes.